Chapter 12. Timeline. When I got home, I tried to go onto Giotti's Facebook page to check it, but she closed it down. I remembered the date Vladimir posted his tirade, 3 months and 8 days ago. The post was actually quite scary. Even the stupids have a kind of logic to their behaviour, which is easy for someone smarter, like me, to discern. Then there are criminals who are actually clinical psychopaths, which doesn't mean they go round hacking people apart the way films depict them. Mum and Dad wouldn't let me see the ones with Sir Anthony Hopkins as Hannibal Lecter, even though they're classics. But I know the plot. There are literally thousands of spoiler reviews on the internet. Their neurochemistry means they simply don't empathize and conform with normal human social constraints. Looking at you, Kenan Abbott and Scrap Owen. That's why they turn to crime. They don't see anything wrong with stealing or threatening other people. Interestingly, the top 1% of them wind up running companies or banks or going into politics. People always misclassify them and call them ruthless. They're not. They simply see an advantage for themselves and take it without any regard for the consequences. It's their nature. Again, I can understand them. Vladimir McCann was not stupid or psychopathic. Michael Finson was right. Vladimir was flat out mad. I went on Vladimir's Facebook page. His posts there were even worse than the one he had wrote on Giotti's page. It was very hard for me to follow his writing. There was nothing rational there. But he did mention his medication, mainly when he wasn't taking it. "Oops, forgot again," he was always saying, or "These new tabs make everything dull. I can't think proper. They space me out too much." A couple of times he talked about being sectioned. "Logging on from inside my padded cell." Which couldn't be right. I'm sure mental hospitals don't allow patients internet access. I couldn't tell what was true or not. You can't analyze something like that. There's no reference point. I wouldn't like it if he'd sent me anything like that. So no wonder Michael was worried and angry. And Michael and Giotti were engaged now. That was something nice to come out of this, I supposed. "How good are the anti-stalking laws?" I asked Dad that night. He gave me a very surprised look and just said, "Why?" This time I'd worked out what to say in advance. It was no good me trying to explain what had been happening. Dad and Rachel don't understand anything that happens outside their view of the world. Their brains aren't big enough. So I wasn't lying to them, just explaining in a way they'd understand. "I saw this strange man today. He was in the Angel Center. I think he was following a woman. She didn't know. He was hanging around outside the shops when she went in. And he sat by himself in Wagamama's when she went in to meet some friends. It was kind of creepy."
"Did you tell her?" Rachel asked me.
"No, I couldn't be sure. It might have been coincidence." "You didn't think so, though, did you?" Dad said. I shook my head. "No, he was acting all weird. But that's just what I thought. The police need solid evidence, don't they?" "Okay, well, the next time you see something like that, tell the mall's security people. They'll know how to deal with it." "Huh," Rachel grunted. "This is what it's like being a woman, Jules. You get some right creeps on the street these days. Harassment is getting worse all the time." "But if she'd complained, would the stalking laws protect her?" I asked. "Not if he's a complete loon," Dad said, "but they're good enough to warn most people off." I went back to Docklands the next day. This time I disguised myself so the building security people wouldn't recognize me. a red T-shirt now and shorts. Yesterday I had a green T-shirt and jeans. I never wear red on Tuesdays, so it was pretty radical. I couldn't bring myself not to wear socks in my sneakers, but I did roll them all the way down so it looked like I wasn't. I borrowed Rachel's baseball cap, the one with her gym logo on the front. Then I finished it off with sunglasses. Dad was just going out to work when he saw me. "Where are you going?" he asked. "Out." "Well, try and avoid those boys from school, okay?" "Sure." His mouth opened, like he was going to say something more, but he just looked at my clothes again and shrugged. "See you tonight." I stayed in the flat for a couple of hours, searching the internet for any files on Vladimir McCann. But he was as bad as Michael when it came to filling in his Facebook details. All it said was that he lived in London. He wasn't reliable enough for me to believe it, not without a confirmed cross-reference. But there wasn't anything on him. He must have been one of those people who lived off the grid. Thinking about it, I supposed I did too. I'd never signed on to any social media site. I don't have friends to message or share photos with, so there's no point. Now I knew more about Michael, I thought about sending him a new message, but I decided against. It's logical. I could just walk up to him and say hello. This gave me the advantage. If he did know who I was, taking security precautions didn't matter. If he didn't know, then he would probably think I'm some kind of weirdo stalker like Vladimir, and he'd probably be all super sensitive about that. So security was important. By security, I meant not saying who I was or where I lived. There's a special technique you can use for getting people to tell you stuff without them realizing what they're doing. It's simple enough. I'd go up to him looking all confident and say something like, "Hi, you're Michael, aren't you? My dad says you used to play football in his league." That way, he'd think he knows me and start talking. According to the internet, it's called soft sideways interrogation. The most famous example ever is Neville Chamberlain, who was Prime Minister just before World War II. He was in a lift in Harrods when a posh young girl and her nanny got in. The girl politely said hello to him and looked very familiar, but he couldn't quite remember her name. So he asked her if her father was still in the same job, thinking she'd say what the job was so he could work out who she was. She replied, "Yes, he's still king." It was Princess Elizabeth. Maybe I won't use that technique. Though actually, Chamberlain did get to find out who she was. I arrived outside Michael's office at 12:25. The same security people were on the entrance. The woman who had looked at me a couple of times yesterday didn't pay any attention to me today. She wore different earrings, small purple ones with the circular peace symbol, which the internet says was designed by CND. I thought it was odd that someone from security would wear those. Michael Finson came out for lunch at 12:37. I liked that. He clearly knew the importance of routine and how easy it makes life. I hadn't even started following him when I began remembering his trip to the police station. It wasn't Mike's happiest memory. I go into the reception area, which is so much smaller than I'd expected, given the size of the station. It's a long way in from the big glass doors, making it oddly dark. The desk is surrounded by thick security glass, and the door beside it has a keypad, so you can't get any further into the building. There's a community service officer in a high-vis jacket sitting at the back of the reception using a computer. I know the cliche about police officers looking younger as you get older,
but he can't have been more than 22. It doesn't inspire me with confidence.
"What can I do for you, sir?" he asks.
"You can start by going and getting a real police officer out here for me to talk to," I think. "One of my fiancé's old boyfriends is threatening her," I tell him.
"In what way?"
"Seriously, do you not understand the word threat?" He posted this on his Facebook page. I hold up my smartphone, which is showing the visitor post. He takes it from me and starts to read. It takes him a long time, longer than it should. The way his face is all creased up, I keep expecting his lips to move silently as he reads. When he finally finishes, he looks up and says,
"There's no threat there, sir."
"What?"
It's odd, granted, but he doesn't actually threaten her with anything.
"You're kidding. He says she's going to come to a dark end. It's right there."
But he doesn't specifically say he's going to harm her. It's more like a prediction based on what happened in Portsmouth.
"They never went to Portsmouth."
"I see." He purses his lips. "Has there been anything else?"
"Well, not yet, no. That's why I'm here, so you can stop it getting out of hand."
"I'm sorry, but this isn't a cause for any kind of police action."
"You mean you won't even talk to him?"
"We have no reason to."
"This is a joke. What are you here for, then? What's the point of having police? You're all useless."
He points to a big poster on the wall, one which says any abusive behaviour towards police personnel will be dealt with severely and may result in civil court action.
"Oh, for..."
I take my phone back off him and turn to leave. "I can give you an incident number, sir," he says.
"What?"
"An incident number for your complaint. That makes it all official, see? So if he bothers your fiancé again, it will be considered as showing a pattern of harassment. Then we may be able to take action."
Almost. I almost just walk out. But instead, I take a breath and say, "Fine. Give me the number then."